Hi, everybody, and welcome to the 19th Hole Golf Show. I'm Ryan Ballengee. It's good to have you here with us. It's May 22nd, 2023. It is my wedding anniversary, 13 years today, very happily married to my wife. And we got a good show for you today, I think, post-PGA Championship show. And we have a guest, Lisa Cornwell, who you may be familiar with her work. She worked with Golf Channel. She does color commentary and play-by-play for PGA Tour Live. She just came out with a new book called Troublemaker. I think it released today, actually, but we recorded the interview last week. And it is a memoir of sorts, kind of looking back at her life leading to Golf Channel, but primarily focused on her career at Golf Channel and what ultimately turned into what seems like a very wrong situation for her and the way that she was treated by Golf Channel and its management, ultimately leading to an EEOC complaint and the process around that. The EEOC ultimately did not take up that case. We talk about that a little bit, the 8% of cases that they do take. That's the end of the show. It's a good interview, I would say a good 24 minutes. So that'll be the back half of the show. And hopefully you'll enjoy that and spend some time listening to what Lisa had to say. And then check out her book. Again, it's called Troublemaker. It's available on Amazon. Easiest way to go get a book these days. You can find it there. I do want to talk about the PGA Championship, kind of start there. And what everything, I mean, really, there are two main stories from the week, right? Brooks Koepka winning, Michael Block winning. And there were two winners. There's no doubt about that. I'll even go further than that and say there was a third winner, which was Oak Hill and Rochester. So let's start with Oak Hill and Rochester. I thought going into this week that it was a very big roll of the dice to have kept their commitment to Oak Hill and have a major championship in upstate Western New York in May. And it could have very easily been a tournament where a cold spell came and the temperatures were in the 50s and 60s and there was a frost delay every morning. And there was a frost delay the first morning. And the weather was supposed to be bad on Friday and Saturday. And it definitely was on Saturday. Friday got windy and it seemed like it might rain, but they got through it. And I mean, from Saturday morning, it seemed like we were destined to go to a rain delay and that this play would spill over into Sunday and there was a realistic chance it'd be difficult to finish on time. They probably would finish, but it'd be difficult to finish on time. And I'll be darned if they didn't finish that round. It was miserable, and I'm sure it was not fun for anybody. But they got the golf in. It cleared up in the late afternoon. Obviously, that helped some of the leaders because that helped separate them via weather, probably to the tune of 2 strokes. Per player in that kind of latter part of the tee times, really created some separation that was already there, just expounded upon it. And they kept it going. And then on Sunday, the golf course looked great. It was in great shape. It was a great test. They got a single digit under par score to win, which I think they were kind of going for here, even with perhaps some softer conditions on Sunday because of the weather the day before. And you had a really compelling matchup. And it was a matchup, frankly, that was different than the matchup you might have understood from 2013 being Duffner and Furyk being close. Well, got closer in the end. And this was a matchup of two very different people, I think, in Brooks Koepka and Victor Hovland. I mean, Hovland has a different kind of demeanor than Brooks Koepka, who walks around very swaggy and like he doesn't care and he doesn't care about you or anything else. And that could very all well be true. I don't get the sensation that he's that guy in reality, just based on how other people greet him. I get the sense that he's probably a pretty decent person, but again, I don't know the guy, so I'm not going to speak for him. But I mean, Rory McIlroy gave him a bro hug when he won. Michael Block gave him a bro hug when he won. I think he's probably a pretty, not smooth operator, but a well-meaning operator. Then he kind of tells you who he is and what he does, and there's no two-facedness, there's none of that. He is who he is kind of guy, except for this public perception that he doesn't care or that nothing bothers him. And I think doing the full swing thing really opened people up to the reality that he was going through when he moved to live, which was that his knee wasn't getting better, he was compensating for it in how he played, he was lost with his golf swing. And that was at a point in time before he got back with Claude Harmon the third. And he turned his game back around before he found these physios down in Florida that have changed his career, that have revitalized his right knee, that have given him the strength and conditioning he needs to be able to play the brand of golf that he plays so well. On the other hand, you have Victor Hovland, who I think a lot of people expect will one day do something good in a major, but they weren't sure how it was going to happen or when it was going to happen. And I think people have been largely surprised that he's been a contender in the last three major championships because of how poorly he chips and putts, or at least that's the perception. Seems like it's different in the major championships. There's also seemingly a different perception about how he carries himself, that he's not a particular, not that he's not serious, but that he doesn't take the world as seriously, perhaps, as Koepka does, or at least the golf as seriously. And I think there's a European sensibility about that. It's from Norway, obviously, and if you haven't heard that before, please don't be surprised. But he seems to kind of carry himself like a guy that's fairly happy-go-lucky, that he knows he's good, he knows he's extremely talented, he knows he can do all of this stuff, but that there's not a not a swagger about it in that regard. You know, the term used these days is that Brooks is an alpha. I think the whole idea of being an alpha is such a farce, but it's not how, whether you're alpha, beta, omega, whatever. It's what you project to the world, and whether you want to project strength to the world, or whether you project nothing to the world, or you just project you to the world. And I think that's what Hovland does, just projects himself. He's just who he is, and very likable, very enjoyable to watch and talk to, and he's cool with that. But it was a very different pair of styles in terms of how they play golf, in terms of how they carry themselves on the golf course. On Saturday night, Hovland said he needed to slow down. He needed to really think about what he was doing on Sunday, knowing what was on the line. Koepka didn't allude to this, but one of his coaches, Pete Cowan, did on Sunday in speaking with Ryan Lavner from Golf Channel. And the lesson that he did allude to, Koepka did allude to, was that he needed to play to win, and he needed to play at his pace, and he didn't need to slow down or think about it, but just to play the style of aggressive golf that he has played that won him four major championships in 24 months, and not to play the kind of golf that cost him maybe four or five major championships in the years since. He learned something playing with Jon Rahm, that he played too conservatively and played himself out of it instead of playing his way into it by trying to win the golf tournament. He learned something, I'm sure, from Phil Mickelson, who slow-walked him at Kiawah Island. And if you don't think he did, you got another thing coming. Mickelson knew what he was doing. He slow-walked Koepka, who likes to play fast, played into the crowd, took his time, really frustrated Koepka. It was the first time I think he had really been gamed like that on that kind of stage. And Tiger games you in a different way, but what really happened at Kiawah was a masterclass in how to get in someone's head or under someone's skin. And he learned from those things, and that he was going to try to dictate the pace, and he was going to try to play quickly and apply pressure because he's a great front runner. He's a tremendous front runner. He understands the psychology of winning from the front because he's done it. And he's done it multiple times. And he's done it against Tiger Woods in St. Louis at Belrive. He's done it against other great players. He did it against Dustin Johnson at Shinnecock. He understands what it means to be ahead and to stay ahead, the importance of staying ahead. And he did that with one noted exception, number six on Sunday. And Hovland was not able to take enough advantage of the mistakes that Koepka did make early in the round, and that was enough for Koepka to slam the door. Because 16 came along, Hovland found the fairway bunker on the tee shot, couldn't get out with his second shot. That was the golf tournament. And the approach shot that Koepka hit from there was incredible in terms of the speed at which he hit it after Hovland's ball had stopped rolling and where he put it. Which was, this is an easy shot. All I have to do is hit the front of the green and roll to the flag and this tournament is probably over. And he did exactly what he needed to do. No thinking about it. He'd done it 10 million times in his life and in his head. Hit the middle of the green, well, front middle of the green, rolled up to the flag, made the birdie, four-shot lead, tournament's over. Even though he dropped the shot on the 17th hole, again, didn't panic, didn't give in to weird thinking. He knew he was four up, didn't have to worry. It was done and dusted at that point. And he wasn't really four up. He was four up on Hovland, but I mean, Scheffler was there and done. There was nothing he could do. So he knew what he had in front of him, and that was it. And he played to that. And then on 18, the embodiment of his week, of realizing that he needed to play an aggressive brand of golf, all 72 holes, pounds a drive down the 18th hole, and from 178 hits it to pin high. The tournament's, I mean, just execution. And the thing I really find impressive about Koepka's major championship game is how he limits mistakes. He does, again, doesn't panic, doesn't freak out, does the smart thing, limits the damage. When he's not playing his best, he doesn't give back strokes. It's a great pace putter. It's a great lag putter. And he puts himself in position to make easy pars instead of bad bogeys. And that difference probably is good for three or four shots a tournament in a major championship, if not more. He doesn't make those kinds of mistakes. And while that kind of game doesn't work for, well, it doesn't universally work at a tour event, either tour, I don't care what tour he's playing, where 20 under can win, when you're putting well and you're hitting it well, those pars turn into birdies. That's how you win on that kind of tour and that kind of setup. But in a major championship, pars are your friend. And having that knowledge to know the difference and to be able to perform under that kind of what seems like pressure to everybody else is really fantastic. It's hard to beat. I don't know if he feels pressure in that same way. I think the Matrix thing where, you know, you kind of see the ones and zeros, I think that moment for him is knowing that pars are fine. And there was a little allusion to this in the laugh piece of Cowan trying to explain to Koepka that he doesn't have to be perfect to win. And I think that is more important to know in the majors than in any other form of this level of golf, of competitive golf. That if you know everyone else is going to make mistakes too, it's who makes the least mistakes with the best results kind of thing, then that's where you find the secret sauce. He knows what you've got to do and how good you've got to be. And it turns out you don't have to be great, and you don't definitely do not have to be perfect. You've just got to be very good and not lose your crap to be able to win a major championship. Let's get into Michael Block a little bit and the week that he had. And just kind of, I've talked about this on some other shows and radio appearances and stuff. And obviously the two stories for the week have been Michael Block and Brooks Koepka. I think nothing else really mattered to anybody. Hovland had a great week. He's going to be an also-ran because of what happened at 16 to a degree. I think we'll come back to that when the day comes that Hovland wins a major championship. At least for now, that's the way it's going to feel. Scottie Scheffler finished, again, in the top 10 in a major, 8th top 10 in a major in the last 10 he's played or something like that. Just outrageously good golf that he's playing right now. And he's back to number 1 in the world. But this is going to feel like maybe not a lost opportunity because of the final round, but maybe a lost opportunity because he just didn't play the first 54 holes to put himself in a position where he could have won this thing, could have given Brooks a showdown. And I kind of hope we get one. I think Scheffler versus Brooks would be really interesting. I think Scheffler versus Rahm would be interesting. I'm hoping we're getting a similar kind of scenario for the next major, right? But we'll see. In the meantime, Michael Block had the week of his life. And how can you not be emotionally moved by that? And I think the reason I got easily emotionally moved by that is a couple things. One, I feel like I try to feel a lot of empathy for put myself in the shoes of what someone is experiencing, high or low, in life, and how I would feel, or how I imagine I would interpret how they are feeling if I were in that unique situation. And the only thing I could think about with Michael Block is how cool it had to have been, and how remarkable it was to me, maybe above all else, that he didn't lose it. I was really worried for him going into the Sunday final round. I figured he's got his biggest pairing of the week. He's got Rory McIlroy. They show the video of him on social. I'm going, are you kidding? I can't believe they're playing with Rory McIlroy. And on one hand, I was worried that it would seem overwhelming, right? I mean, everyone knows his story at this point. This isn't a surprise anymore. This isn't just a feel-good thing. This is a, hey, if you do something crazy here today, you could finish top five in a major thing. And I was wondering if that would really get to him and would cause him to just fall off, and he'd shoot close to 80 and he'd get a pity clap from everybody, and he would get a hero's welcome, I am sure, if he had played poorly anyhow, but that it wouldn't have been quite the same level as what he got in the end for what he did. But I think it turned out that it was a great pairing for him, because McIlroy is accommodating, he is friendly. Well, I'm sure McIlroy was still trying to do something, trying to find a way to catch up to Brooks, but that he knew the odds were against him. And obviously later in the round, he knew it definitely wasn't going to happen, so they were playing golf for different reasons. McIlroy was playing golf to make as much money as he could, I guess, but ultimately not win another major. And Block was trying to play into the top 15 to get into next year's PGA Championship. And also, frankly, earn as much money as he can, because it's not like he's playing in designated tournaments for $20 million purses. Like, this is his thing. $17.5 million purse, if you make a great week of it and you make a boatload of money, that's multiple years' salary, perhaps, in his line of work. And that's life-changing money. That's retirement money. Not to retire, but to have enough money to retire eventually when you put in your 401k or whatever. I don't know if he was thinking about that in the moment, but that it all unfolded the way that he did, that he hung on as well as he did. And then to get to 15 and to dunk it and to have a moment of a lifetime and to not even see it go in, just to hear people go crazy, have McIlroy come at you and hug you, not entirely sure of what's happened. I'm sure he kind of got a sense, but you never really know until you see it. And then to get that up and down on 18, that was what really moved me. I mean, when you, a hole in one where you have 10,000 people just going nuts for you, I mean, I don't even know how you put that into context. But he kept it together. He was leaking oil a little bit, though. And he did this really amazing thing of getting up and down on the final hole. And he knew. He knew what that meant. He knew if he was able to get up and down, he would finish in the top 15. He would avoid qualifying. He would have thousands upon thousands of people cheering for him. Not the, oh, and then the polite clap, but a thunderous roar. And that's what he got with that last revolution of the ball going in the hole. And when it went in, and he kind of put his hands on his thighs, and he knew what that meant. He couldn't believe that it was, one, that had happened, but two, that it all had happened. And I think that was kind of the release moment of, I can't believe this. I can't believe that went in. I can't believe all these people are cheering. I can't believe I'm in the PGA Championship next year. I made hundreds of thousands of dollars. That I played this well for this week, and this best week of my life, and I can't believe it's over. Because that's it. And yes, obviously it extended well beyond that moment, to be able to hug his caddy, to be able to get hugged again from McIlroy, who said it was effing awesome, to be able to hear from 10 to 15,000 people around that green who loved him, and to give that back for a minute, to hug his wife, to the trophy presentation for being low club or low professional, to have all the kind of different club pros and people who are working at the PGA of America dap him up, that was a big deal. To have Brooks Koepka come up to him after he had won a fifth major title, one of the biggest moments of his personal life, to go up to him and share some happiness and say, hey, here, you're buying drinks. Yeah, that was a cool thing too. And then for it to go down the way that he did with the interview with Amanda Renner, who did a great job at CBS, I think, and showing the video footage of everyone at his club in Mission Viejo, California, just going nuts, and I think his son shot it. That was incredible. I wouldn't even have gotten to the 18th green for the presentation. Being a puddle, I would still be swimming out of it. And he did it all with the right levers of emotion, to the confidence, the faux dad confidence of when things go right, and the humility to take it all in and give it all back in a positive way, to just really embrace the moment and be present for it, I think was really cool. And yes, this is going to go over the top, right? In like 2 weeks, we'll be like, okay, we had enough of that. Very cool. Enjoyed your time at Oak Hill. Very cool that you got into Colonial. But, that's good. And he's going to go back. He's going to go play the Canadian Open, I'm sure. They invited him to play. And he might even play once more. And he's going to have the opportunity this week to take a victory lap. Then he's going to go back to his home club. And he's going to get to relive that over and over again for years to come. Which is really cool. And that's the thing I think most people don't think about. Is that he has a job giving lessons. They're $150 an hour. Probably price is going up. But he has a book of business that he's working with, and he sees these people that come and play his club all the time. And he's going to have an opportunity to spend so much time with them. And I bring this back to conversation I had and recorded some of it. Might even put it on the show next time. But I had a conversation with Megan Francella, who's an LPGA winner, and she is now teaching pro at Philly Cricket Club. And she was at the Dormy Network doing teaching for a while and really gotten into it after walking away as a player and then caddied on the tour for a while and now in this teaching role. But she got an exemption into the ShopRite LPGA Classic. And she talked about the importance of the interaction with her members and how they've supported her and how they're trying to help prepare her for this moment where she gets to return to the LPGA Tour and play. And they're trying to do anything, come up with games, handicap games, 3-on-1 games, all those plus players want to play with, all these different things where they're trying to prepare her for something that is hard to prepare for. And she seems so happy with that embrace. And I think that's just something a lot of people just covet. There aren't many true loners in the world who really don't need that. And even the ones who really don't could really use it. To be embraced by people, not just because of the money that you have or the status that you have, but because you make a connection with them on a personal level, whether it's service-based or just friendship-based or service becomes friendship, leadership, those types of things, they really stick. And when people care for you, it means a lot. And people are going to eventually forget Michael Block for a while, right? The people who watch this championship casually and stuff like that, they had a great week with him and they made a connection with him and maybe he with them in some ways, but that'll kind of change. But what will not change and what will not go away is the added connection he has with the people he gets to serve and work with every day. And that's really cool. And I think that's what it comes down to for me, that I'm emotional about what he accomplished. For one, because I think being able to take advantage of a dream scenario and just kind of, I don't know, float through air whilst playing tremendous golf is incredible. But then to be able to do that with your family watching, your personal family, your work family, your golf family, and to be able to enjoy that with them for a long time to come. Because he will be having, people will come into that pro shop for 5 years now, or come to a lesson with him for 5 years and ask him about that day. And he will get to bring that back and delight people with that story for a long time. That's the lasting enjoyment of this is really cool to me. And I say that because today is my wedding anniversary. And I think about the time that I've spent with my wife for 13 years now, and I've known her for nearly 16 years. And the bonds that we have made with each other, but also the bonds that we've made with, obviously, our children, with two, and the people that we've met along the way, the adventures that we've been on, the connections that we've made, and to, just to be able to talk with those people, I mean, that brings me a tremendous amount of joy. I can't imagine the amount above and beyond to be able to talk with the people that you shared those moments with, whether you were inside the ropes with them, whether they were watching from afar, whatever. It's really cool, something to cherish forever. Congratulations to him. I would love to see the TaylorMade folks make a run of Why Not balls and covers and do a little merch run for Michael Block. I think he deserves that. I think people would buy it too, honestly. But it'd be really cool for him. And I hope he really, really does get to truly embrace and appreciate everything after all of this, because there's still more to come for him. All right. Let's get into the interview for this week. Lisa Cornwell is my guest, and I interviewed Lisa last week ahead of the release of her book, Troublemaker, and it was a really quick read for me. It's a memoir that goes over her life leading up to working at Golf Channel, whether that's playing competitive golf, family, known Tiger Woods, being part of the Clinton family, and the experiences with Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, and to be able to then illuminate her experience with Golf Channel, a very, sounds like a terrible situation, not something anyone would want to go through, and it's worth reading it all in the book, but I didn't want to ruin the book at the same time. So to kind of put it all into perspective, Lisa talked about her situation. It's a little bit inside baseball in some of this, so we try to explain that as best humanly possible, but it is absolutely worth your time to read, whether you've gone through something like this or not, and to kind of understand the difficult position, nearly impossible position, she was put in, and not only just her, but other people at Golf Channel, which she details a little bit in our conversation in the book, and it's worth your time. So I hope you enjoy this conversation with Lisa Cornwell. Lisa Cornwell joins me. She is the author of Troublemaker, a memoir of sexism, retaliation, and the fight they didn't see coming. If you haven't seen the cover, it's out. Very excited to have her here with us. This was a really quick read for me. I think a quick read because it's compelling, but also because you made it very relatable, your life story, and then kind of drew people in with your background to what ultimately happened to your experience at Golf Channel. But I kind of want to lead with, at what point did you decide you were going to write this? And I feel like I'm asking that as someone who's always curious why people decide to put pen to paper and decide to write something so personal and put it out there for the world to experience.
Well, it's interesting, Ryan. First of all, thanks for having me. You know, in my dedication, I said one of the people I dedicated this book to was my mom, who's always wanted me to write a book. She said, Lisa, you know, you've had all these incredible stories. You really need to put them out there. And I thought, nobody wants to read a book by me. You know, I don't have that much to say. And, you know, there were some things that happened even pre-Golf Channel, as you know from reading it, that that were important for me to talk about, things that I've been through. I talk about an eating disorder, my burnout from golf. I think a lot of things that everyday human beings, whether you're male, female, whatever, we're not immune to it. Just life kind of gets in the way. And so I think from that regard, I always kind of thought about possibly putting it out there and sharing my story in the hopes that maybe it could help somebody else with his or her story. And then the Golf Channel part rolled along. And I noticed when I spoke out, and I'm sure that you saw this, when I put that first public tweet out on January 1, 2021, when I wasn't in contract, that I was trying to get this message out via social media, which is absolutely no way to put out a social put out information or your experiences, especially when they're so long and drawn out. But I was attempting to, and I was really angry. And then as time was going on, even though I was involved in this legal case, you know, I didn't know how much that I could say, but I thought, you know, regardless, I don't know if I'm going to pursue this down the line if the EEOC doesn't take the case, just because of the sheer expense of it. So I reached out to Tucker and I thought, okay, let's at least sort of start this process, you know, with a proposal and get everything in order. And then lo and behold, it just kind of fell in line. But yeah, it took a little bit to be fully committed. But look, at least in the beginning, it was very cathartic. It was a good outlet for me, and certainly better than going to Twitter.
Did you have a fair percentage of this done before you even really decided that you wanted it to be a book? Did you do any kind of writing or journaling or note-taking of not just to be contemporaneous for an EEOC case, but because you wanted to kind of have a documentation of what you've experienced these last few years?
Well, I had a lot of notes because of the EEOC case. So from the Golf Channel perspective, that was pretty easy to put together. And I will say, when it came to that part in the book, Tucker did a lot of the heavy lifting, because how do you write a story about a legal case and make it compelling? And that's really where Tucker stood out and did a good job, I think. So once we actually got the deal, I did more of the early writing in the book, where it was more about my life and, experiences, because that can't really come from somebody else. And that's pretty easy to tell. The chapters aren't long. I try to go into as much detail as I can recall to share it. But yeah, no, we didn't have a lot of it written. I mean, once we got the book deal, that's kind of when we went fast and furious. And I think that it was last April, and literally we had to have the manuscript turned in by September. So, I had started a podcast, and I literally had to put everything aside. So I was writing nonstop and doing PGA Tour Live, and that's it. I mean, I stopped doing yard work, Ryan, which is a big deal for me. That's my therapy. So everything else went away, even golf. I barely played golf. So it's kind of like, it was a great experience. I'm not a writer by trade. I'm one and done. So I'm glad that we're in the process now of talking about it rather than the writing and editing portion of it.
You brought up Tucker Dale Booth or Tucker Booth. If you know him on Twitter, you know him. But if you don't, can you kind of give people a background on how you got in touch with Tucker and how you collaborated with him and what that discussion might have been like up front of how you were going to work together?
Yeah, so he had never written a book, and I saw that he had tweeted out something about Michael Whalen. It was a profile piece on Michael and the sort of what he went through, not only with Golf Channel, but his personal battles with mental health issues. And as I started reading this, I was just captivated by it. I was fascinated as much by the story, but the storytelling aspects and the way that Tucker presented it. I knew at that point that I couldn't afford to go hire a seasoned ghostwriter or co-author. Tucker had never written a book. He had actually reached out to me after I put out that tweet on January 1st and asked me to come on his podcast. And that's when I started researching him. And I came across that profile piece, and we had a discussion. And I knew immediately. I thought, if I do end up writing a book, this is the guy I want to help me do it, because his voice just really spoke to me through those words. And, since then, he's become like a brother to me. I love Tucker. He has gone to battle for me. He believed in this whole story from day one. And I will say, he vetted me. It was, and I encouraged him to do so. He said, if I'm going to write a book with you and put my name on it, I want to make sure that you're legitimate. And I said, absolutely. Please call around, ask around, dig deep, and then let's talk again. And we did.
What has the response been? And keeping in mind that social media is the weirdest place in the world, but what is the kind of the spectrum of the response been from maybe people who are in this line of work, whether that's TV writing, some form of media, versus people who are outside that line of work, men versus women? I mean, what has there been a gamut of kind of range of responses based on where people come from in life?
They've really been pretty equal, and a lot of people knew that I think the claims and the accusations that I were making were real, just because, if you understand the culture at Golf Channel, it doesn't surprise you. It doesn't surprise anyone, man or woman, what can happen in corporate America. I will say, some of the feedback that has meant the most to me have been the select number of folks who I used to work with who have read it. And I got a message from somebody who I worked with in studio, who was part of the crew, the floor crew. And the response was like, I knew that there were things going on. I didn't know all this happened. You hid it from us very well. And, thanks for standing up for all of us. And it was a heartwarming, not as much about the book, but just about our relationships and the bonds and friendships that we all formed. And, you know, to be able to do our jobs and to work and enjoy each other despite the chaos. I think that it was a good reminder of that because I did love my job. You know, I did love the people I worked with. I did love covering golf. And, you know, I miss those folks. And so I think that response has been great. But a lot of it has been kind of what you said, too. It was an easy read. It was a quick read. I'm not one of those people who tries to go to thesaurus and use, you know, big words and, you know, to try to sound like I went to Harvard because I didn't. I'm very proud of, you know, my Southern education, SEC education. So, I think the response has been, thanks for putting all this out there because we didn't quite understand, but now we do.
Do you wish, based on that response, that maybe you would have put it out there to other people that were your coworkers at the time, that it might have been a help somehow, either emotionally as you're going through this, probably feel like you're on an island in some sense, or even from a management perspective going to bat for you?
So, you know, I really try not to have a lot of regrets. But with everything that happened with Golf Channel, I do have one regret, and that's not going to HR when there was a clear violation of employment law, and that being in terms of my relationship with Sarah and how they handled that and trying to take me off of covering a women's event for false accusations. So, you know, it was on the heels of the Angela Aiken, Sergio Garcia fallout, and people will read that. Those chapters really are close together. And for folks who don't know about the story, and most of them won't, because Angela, she spoke out a little bit, but not a lot. But, you know, in the end, ended up losing her job because she was in a relationship that she didn't disclose with Sergio Garcia, which was ridiculous. I mean, Angela was so good at her job. She was fair. She was objective. She didn't do anything to cross the lines. And then I follow up and kind of deal with sort of the same thing, but how they handled it on the back end with me, given the fact that I disclosed everything that I should have disclosed, I went, you know, but I shouldn't have even had to disclose it. First of all, that was ridiculous, but it's kind of hard to talk about without giving the story away, but it's a really important part of the book to me. And it's with Golf Channel, the one regret that I didn't have, not going to HR, but maybe contacting a lawyer at that point and handling it the way that it should have been handled, because it was a serious matter.
Do you think that things would have gone differently for you had things not happened the way they did for Angela ahead of you or around the same time as you?
No, I think eventually it would have happened to me. And here's why, because if you're a woman at Golf Channel and you speak out, you don't have a long, you're not going to have a long history there. And I say that because I'm not the only one who that happened to. I mean, there is a parade of women who have been outspoken, who have tried to fight back on wrongdoings, and eventually they're shown the door. I mean, we talked about Chelsea Kite in the book, and Chelsea wrote that one aspect from her own words, and look what happened to her. She went to HR, she spoke out about it. She tried to go against her bosses who were clearly trying to do her harm in her job. And she was asked to leave. She wasn't renewed. So it's not just me. It's not just Chelsea. There are numerous counts of women, all of whom, or many of whom, came to me after I spoke out and said, you know, this happened to me too. And it's unfortunate. It's heartbreaking to know that these things happen to hard workers, people who cared about their jobs. And that's why I think it's important to get the story out there.
What is it about media, maybe Golf Channel specifically, / NBC Universal, that created a retaliatory environment for so many people, including yourself?
It's just that old boys club culture. And I say that in the fact that, you know, our main boss was a woman, but she was part of the boys club. So it's not just always a male issue. I mean, you know, I talk about in there that she's the biggest disappointment of my professional career, because as a woman going into a sports network, you know, you have all of these expectations and sort of breathe a sigh of relief, thinking, okay, there's a woman in charge. This isn't, we're not going to fight the same battles. When in essence, I fought the biggest battles that I've ever fought in sports media with a woman in charge, because she so badly wanted to remain part of the boys' club that she overlooked everything. And it made it worse for all of us. And, you know, truthfully, it made it worse for her too. We wrote in the book about how when you do that as a woman, you basically become a pawn. And people know that they can manipulate you. They know that they can take advantage of you, and they did. And like, there are a lot of unfortunate angles and sides to this story. And that's why I really hope everybody will read it and with those things in mind and put it all together, kind of like you did. It doesn't take a genius to figure out what happened. You know, it's right there in front of you. The stories are right there. They're all verifiable. Nothing that I put in the book happened to just me, you know. I mean, people know about all these accounts. And so that's why I will fully stand behind any sort of backlash or allegations or charges, because, you know, you can't fight the truth.
Has there been any kind of response from NBC Universal or Golf Channel to you, publicly or privately, having seen what you've written, or, you know, ahead of it being available for public sale?
They haven't read it, not to my knowledge. So it's not available until May 23rd. And we've been very careful in that regard in terms of who we've sent out galley copies to and let read it, because like, they'll eventually read it. They'll see what's in there. I spell it all out. I name a lot of names. I think that Molly's name's mentioned over 120 times. Her husband's name's mentioned over 130 times. There's a chapter devoted to Brandel Chamblee. So, you know, they're all going to read it, and they'll read it very soon. So I can tell you this, I wouldn't want my name mentioned in a book like that, but I don't think my name ever will be, because I know how to treat people right. It's not really that difficult. So I think that, you know, in essence, that's kind of the moral of the story. Just do the right thing, treat people right, and you won't be a chapter or a multiple mention in a book like this.
Are you kind of surprised Molly and Jeff, and this is probably inside baseball for some people, so I apologize for the question. People are not going to understand this, but for Molly and Jeff, are you kind of surprised they're still in this power structure in which they exist at this point, having gone through the situation with you and with Angela, but also the huge transition that has happened at Golf Channel as a network from Orlando, Florida to Stamford, Connecticut?
Well, Jeff retired, so
Oh,
shortly after
okay.
all of this, I think that there was probably a little bit of writing on the wall after all this happened, especially after the Mizuno incident. That's chapter one of the book, and followed up with the remainder of the story later in the book. But I'm sure that there was sort of the reality check that what we're doing here isn't right in terms of the power structure. I mean, it's the clear, what they had going on is a clear definition of nepotism, right? I mean, it's how in the world it was allowed. And I like how you say inside baseball, but just in a nutshell for folks listening, my boss who hired me, the executive producer, Molly Solomon, her husband at Golf Channel was the executive editor. However, when an opening came for somebody to be head of news operations, head of on-air talent, they put him in that role. But in order for him not to report directly to his wife, they had to give him an SVP title. So just think about that. They gave him that so he would report directly to the president. But when you're somebody like me and you upset Jeff Russell, who sleeps every night with Molly Solomon, who's the executive producer, I mean, for lack of a better word, you're screwed. And that's what happened. So my job was safe until Jeff took over that role. And everything changed once he got into that position. And it was just it was, there was a struggle from kind of the beginning, just from his management style that I didn't really respect. It was very authoritarian, even though, look, he wasn't a production guy. He didn't have that background. He was, you know, from the editorial world. He had
Right.
no business overseeing on-air talent. So, it's a crazy twist to the story. I mean, I kind of felt like I was writing a script for Days of Our Lives, you know, because a lot of this stuff you can't make up. Unfortunately, I'm not that creative. So It's an interesting but unfortunate story that I would say is all too common, but I don't think that that nepotism side of it's that common anymore. I'm really shocked that NBC allowed that to happen.
Beyond the very obvious dysfunction of having Molly and Jeff being a 1-2 punch, is there anything about Golf Channel that you would prescribe to change to prevent the things that have happened to you from happening to someone else in a similar role?
I think when you have good people in charge, these things don't happen. And I say that because, I'm working now for PGA Tour Live. Only, it's a fraction of what I used to do at Golf Channel. But the management is fantastic. They care about treating people right. They care about equality. They care about fairness. There aren't any egos. Bad attitudes are left at the door because if you come in there with that kind of attitude, you'll be shown the door. I mean, nobody ever says that, but you just kind of know that it's this go into work, do your job, treat people right, and you'll keep coming back. So I think that I really appreciate now I will say I think that they brought in Mark Lazarus to run the Golf Channel production side. So I think he reports to Molly, and I've heard nothing but good things about him. So I think that having good people in charge and good people running things will obviously make the whole environment better. And, if somebody said, "What's your wish for companies and places like Golf Channel?" It's simply just to hire decent people who treat people right. And nobody's going to write a book about you. It won't happen.
Your experience of dealing with filing an EEOC complaint and the seems like the very bureaucratic disregard for it in times. How do you take away what do you take away from that entire experience and beyond disappointment? And is there something that as a protagonist in this that future people can do to maybe either speed up the process or get the attention of the EEOC better to have a better outcome?
Look, I think that that's the most important question. And it's, I think, the answer that I'm still searching for. And it'll take a lot smarter minds than me to figure it out and a lot of people coming together to figure it out. What I have learned from this experience is that it is very expensive and daunting and challenging and tiring to take on a corporation. So when you go through the EEOC, for folks who don't learn, and I wanted or don't know about it, I wanted to put this in the book because even going into it, I didn't know about it. I didn't really know what the EEOC was. But so the EEOC basically takes on, from what I've read, 7 to 8% of the cases that come to them every single year, tens of thousands of discrimination, retaliation cases, and they only fund less than 10% of them. And that's important. It's an important number because if they aren't funding it, how can a $30,000 target manager afford to sue Target in federal court? Think about that, because your best employment lawyers don't work on contingency. They're $800, $1,200 an hour, and you can't afford that. Even for somebody like me who had a good job, once I lost my good paying job, that's a big financial risk to take them to federal court. And so I went the writing the book route because, like my lawyer told me, he said, "Look, we have a good case. Obviously, we have all of this documentation." He said, "But I can't guarantee that a jury's going to, award you the kind of compensation that it will take to cover my fees and everything else." So, that's one thing that I think that in this country that we really have to figure out. The EEOC needs to be better funded so they can take on more cases. There has to be more oversight. HR has to be an independent body. I could go on and on, but I think that these are really important questions for our leaders and our legislature and our Congress and our Senate. I mean, these are things that really need to be addressed.
It feels like there is a structure out there that there didn't used to be for whistleblowers, corporate whistleblowers of financial crime, but not necessarily interpersonal crime. And I don't understand why those resources haven't been committed to that, given exactly what you've talked about. And they have to know their own statistics of malfeasance.
Yeah, it has to be out there. And I did a lot of research on cases like this. And the biggest one that I found was the Pinterest COO who sued Pinterest for discrimination. And she won the case. I mean, she had clear evidence, clear documentation. But again, you're talking about a woman who's in a COO position of a company the size of Pinterest. So she had, what, a 7 or 8 figure income. She
Right.
can afford the best lawyers in the country. And I guess that kind of goes back to what we're both saying here is that, okay, she can take them on, but most of your cases aren't with people making, $5, $10 million. Most of
Right.
them are people like me are making a lot less than even what I made. So I don't know. It is kind of to me the million-dollar question is how do we make this better? But I do know that the EEOC needs more funding. The last 10 years, funding for that department, that organization has gone down, and it went down dramatically during COVID. So that certainly is a big focus for me and something that I will continue to push and try to educate myself and others on.
So to spin it forward from here beyond, working with PGA Tour Live, you've said it has been great. You do a great job with it. What is your kind of hope and aspiration for the next step of your career and then also your life with Sarah?
Yeah, that's my other million-dollar question, I think, trying to figure out what's next. I really am in this sort of in-between position in my life, transitioning out of traditional media and focusing on this book. I mean, obviously, Sarah's playing on the LPGA tour. She's having a very solid year, and I try to be as supportive in that role. But it's great too, because it keeps me connected to the LPGA and connected to the players who I developed these great relationships with over the years. When I go out and watch her play and see all those folks in player dining now instead of the media center, it's a lot of fun, and I've gotten to know them on a more personal level because I always tried to keep it separate when I was in my role at Golf Channel. I thought that it was important, for me to be able to do that and to do my job the most effectively. As far as my own thing, obviously I'm happy about continuing the work in golf with PGA Tour Live, and I hope to always continue that. I really want to be an advocate in this arena for women and for men or anybody who's had to deal with retaliation or discrimination. It doesn't just happen to women. It happens across the board. I was talking to a friend of mine yesterday. Her husband's a baseball coach, and she was talking to me about how she thinks he was pushed out because of his age. So it happens all over the place. But I really care about this. Obviously, I want to use my voice however I can. I want to speak to women as much as I can. I've learned, Ryan, I think more than anything through this is that there is a real fear in women to speak out. And I understand that because you worry about being blackballed in an industry. I mean, I can promise you ESPN or CBS or any of those other, networks, they're not going to come knocking down my door. I mean, because they're afraid of somebody calling you out because these things do go on. They still go on, as this book proves. But I want to be there for women. I want to be an outlet for women who have been through something like this, who may want to speak out. They want to know the proper route to take, what they can do, what they should be doing personally and publicly. I just think that they're important stories, and I'm always an advocate not only for their stories, but just people speaking out, because that's the only way that you make things better.
Lisa, thank you for coming on and talking with me. Like I said, the book is a great read. It's a quick read. It's important for people, whether they've been through what you've been through or not, to understand what you've been through. So I think most people can find this easily on Amazon. I think that's how most people buy things anymore. But that's
Yeah.
the easiest way to get a hold of this great book, Troublemaker, by Lisa Cornwell. Thank you again for being with us.
Thanks, Ryan.
Thank you again to Lisa for being on the show. I really appreciate it. Again, I think it's a book that you can read quickly and still get a lot out of. It's not light reading because it is emotional in nature and it'll get you riled up, I think, to a degree. But I think it's worth reading something like that to better understand how things like that happen in the media business, things like this happen in the working world, and for the progress that gets made in some facets of life. In others, things like this happen, you wonder how it's still happening, but that it is. And thank you for Lisa for telling the story and being on with me. Next week, we will talk about golf stuff. We will have a guest, Matt Considine, who is the founder of the New Club Golf Society, will join me. We've already recorded the interview, had a great conversation. We'll talk about his golf society, how he got into it, what it does, all of this good stuff. Talk about that. Probably run the audio from Megan Francella for you, because I thought that was pretty cool. Just kind of talk with her about growing as a player and maybe the reverse order in which she's kind of getting smarter about the game at this stage and how she kind of wished she'd done it a little bit sooner in her career. Talk about that a little bit. Just 5 minutes of audio worth listening to. And we'll get some other stuff too. If you catch us as a podcast on a platform, let you do that. If you'll leave us a 5-star review and a comment and appreciate it, you can hit me up on Twitter at Ryan Ballingy. You can find me on Instagram too with the same name. You can email me, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com. I appreciate all of your support, likes, follows, conversations over the years. It's always great to talk golf with you. I'm back next week with another show. Hope you have a great week, everybody. We'll see you next time on the 19th Hole Golf Show.